welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to today's episode of Turn the Page podcast. I'm one of your librarian hosts, Stacy, and I'm here with
Laurel K. Hamilton.
Woo! And Jessica. I'm so excited for this.
I'm excited. She told me she was interviewing you, and I was like, can I be on this? When did you not tell me? Because I've read your books.
Well, I am glad that you're here with us today, then, that we're all here.
So this, we are here to chat about Smolder, which is, what number are we talking?
It is book 29 in the Anita Blake series.
So tell us a little bit about it, and then we can chat about Anita Blake and all the fun things that come with it.
Yeah.
I'm always really bad at giving away just enough but not too much. So, Smolder, I turned in about a month ago. I just turned in, I am doing the edits on the next book, which since there is the first chapter of that book in the back of Smolder in the hardback, I can say the title, which is Slay. And it's S-L-A-Y, by the way, we're not doing a Christmas episode kind of thing. And so because that book is loudest in my head, I'm going to have to be careful to not talk about the wrong book. It's one of those. Smolder is when we are finally finding out that just because they've crowned you king of the vampires for Jean-Claude of America, the first king of America, though doesn't mean that everybody else is on board with that. And we're going to find out that because it's a modern world and the big ancient vampires are supposed to be either dead or not caring, like basically they've turned their back on the world, doesn't make it so. Doesn't make it so, because Jean-Claude has now amassed more power in the modern world than any other vampire. So it's like blood in the water to sharks. The ancient vampires are going, we could have a lot of power and we could be in control of the entire country and we don't have to mass an army to do it. These modern worlds, this is great. And we're going to see Jean-Claude up against somebody who really gives him a run for his money for the amount of power that mystical power, which we haven't really had to go up against as much since the Mother of All Darkness. And so it was very interesting to see Jean-Claude and Anita and other people around them fight this. And at the same time, Jean-Claude it's really brought home to Jean-Claude that he is not he can do defense, but he's not an offense power. It's love and lust is his secondary power. And that's great. It means we don't have to kill people to raise power. I am all for this. But it also means that if we are attacked by somebody that love and lust have no effect on, Jean-Claude doesn't have a lot of other abilities. And I show this on stage in a very stark way. And it was both very fun and very frightening to go, oh crap. It's like that moment in Dungeons and Dragons when you realize you didn't have your party put together quite the way you needed to take out the big major bad guy. And you're going, we're all gonna die now. But I can rewrite tomorrow. I don't have to roll the dice right then and have no saving throw. So it was very interesting to watch Jean-Claude realize this, watch Anita realize this, and go, no matter how much power you have, there's always somebody out there bigger and badder than you are. And that's true across a lot of different things in life, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So that's part
fabulous.
Of it.
Yes.
And also we get to see them, you know, try to have a date night, and Anita gets some revelations about how she feels about dressing up and doing the full makeup and how, as a woman, it's just very conflicting. It's very full of conflicts because, we're looking at the wedding stuff. I have been researching because we're like more than a book away from the wedding, but I have been researching wedding weddings and royal weddings and everything they put the women in. You better have somebody there with a sword to protect you, because you can't run or walk in these dresses. And the shoes and everything. Everything that women wear makes them helpless. And with Anita dressed for a date, when the big fight comes up, suddenly we get to talk about the fact that I can't save myself in these heels. I can barely walk on a sidewalk in these heels. And that's just my little soapbox I've stayed on in this whole series, which is how much of what is considered traditionally feminine makes us victims or makes us need to be rescued by somebody or helped by somebody. So it's a book about power. It's a book about mystical power, vampire politics, and the dynamics of power are the how it works with so many things. And we get to see Jean. And because it was the 29th book, and I knew I was going to do the 30th book right after, so they're both coming out this year, I took us back to Guilty Pleasures, which we hadn't really been at. Guilty Pleasures is the first book. And now finally, this is the first time we've been in Guilty Pleasures in a long time, and we get to see Jean-Claude back on stage again. And that was very fun. That was just totally fun. And so that was... It led into all the politics, but because the older vampires don't think it's, they think that their king should not be taking his clothes off on stage. It is beneath him and beneath them, that it lowers their threat ability, that their king is still stripping on stage. And I don't know, have some fun. You're living forever. Can't lighten up kind of thing. So that was a very, very not clear what this book is about, but it's about politics, vampire politics. It's about power. It's about the fact that no matter how much power you accumulate, there's always a bigger, badder thing out there. And the theme of power dynamics runs through the book.
That's an exciting description of it, though, because you touch upon so many different things that a variety of readers can like pick up on and ride with, rather than just like, oh, you know. I think that's one of the things I love about the series and your writing, is that I first got attracted to it with your first book, Guilty Pleasure. I was like, yeah, vampire romance. and for the listeners of this, I just did a little dance because that's, I like that. I like vampires. But reading into
classic
the series.
Stacey right there doing a dance.
But I was just like, reading through the series, it becomes so much more than just, okay, there's a vampire. You have such a way with world building and all these different things that I'm like, oh, what's this? That like, I want to like then be like, okay, I got to go on like a wiki hole of like all of this. This is cool. What about this? Of introducing things of urban fantasy that I was like, oh, I never thought of this. Oh, I like this. Like you do so much more, and it's so interesting to read about it and all the different characters I love. And even though I can't personally relate to Anita because I am not short and I'm not a necromancer, nor do I have paranormal paramours.
Don't sell yourself short. You're a little.
No, I joke that my husband's a werewolf because he's really hairy. But aside from that, it's just so interesting because there's certain things I could be like, oh, I'm kind of like this one. Oh, I like this of this one, and I could feel connected to the variety of characters that you write.
Oh, well, thank you. One of the reasons that there's more than vampire romance is I didn't know it was a romance when I started out. I thought it was a mystery with paranormal elements. That's what I thought it was. I thought it was a horror mystery. And I my writing group can tell you, I was loud and firm that Jean-Claude would never be a romantic lead. In my head, he was the villain. In my head, he was the villain, and he would. But of course, as the books went along, by book three, I knew I was in trouble. That he was wearing us down or winning us over, and I was going, no, I'm not going to do that. The romantic vampire, I'm not going to do that. And you know, the character Richard Zeman was brought on in book three because I created him to be the perfect, quote unquote, perfect man for Anita. My plan was that she would marry him, and Jean-Claude would kind of just take it on the chin and be a gentleman about it. And of course, that's so not what worked, because just as trying to fix up your friends usually goes horribly wrong, trying to fix up my imaginary characters went totally pie-shaped. So it's interesting because I didn't know I was writing romance for the longest time. It means that I broke a lot of tropes that were traditional in romance. Horror, I was still fine. I haven't broken any tropes for horror, except for the fact that the slasher flick trope, where it's only the virgin that survives. One of the reasons Anita had sex in the series finally was the fact that a fan came up to me at a signing and said to me that, "Oh, it's nice that you're doing the slasher trope." I said, "What do you mean I'm doing the slasher trope?" And she says, "Well, Jean, the good girl survives, and if you're a bad girl, you die." And I went, "What?" And she explained it to me, and I went, "Oh my God, no, that's not what I mean. That's not what I meant. That's not what I'm doing." And so one of the reasons we finally had sex on stage in the series was the fact that I wanted to make sure that everybody understood that, as far as I was concerned, Anita was trying to make an emotional connection enough to where she felt comfortable to have sex with somebody. I wasn't meaning that you had to be a good girl to survive in my world. I think that is a very negative message.
Oh, yeah.
Your survival should not be based on your sexual morality or your body count or whatever you want to call it. That was not my intent. So you have that one fan who was so happy that I was doing it, and then I went and did the opposite to thank for the fact that I finally went, "Oh God, no, must do this sooner." So it's interesting because it was very interesting talking to fans. It was the fans that first let me know that it was a romance. Does that isn't that I'm the writer, but no, the fans were the ones that told me what I was writing.
Interesting, because that was actually something I kind of wanted to ask you is, what I love when you're talking about just, getting to this 29th book and how the wedding is a certain amount of books away. And of course, how Jean-Claude was not meant to be a romantic character. And then it was like, I don't know about that. Was like, what I wanted to know originally was, do you have like that pin board of, where you definitely are going? But it almost seems like your characters and the world sort of comes up and trips you as you're taking the path.
I'm what George R. R. Martin coined the term pantser, which it's not my favorite, that I fly by the seat of my pants, and that's not entirely true. I will outline the mystery in the book for clues and who done it or what done it. But yes, I am a character-driven writer, and if my characters come up with a better idea than I have, then I will follow that. Now, sometimes it follows to a dead end, but most of the time, my characters have a much better idea for where things need to go. Some books, if I know, like at this point in the series, I'm 29 books in with a large cast of continuing characters. So I will have the mystery plot, I will have the character arc, certain things that are going to happen, and it's interwoven. But I've had a couple of books where the mystery took the back seat to the personal stuff because it's just so there's so much of it, and it's interesting, and that's what the book is about. So no, I have no overall plan. I planned to kill Jean-Claude in book three. That was my plan. He was supposed to die at the end. And then when we came to it, I realized it was too late. I would have missed him. Anita would have missed him. It was too late. But I thought he would take over my series if he stayed in the series, and I was right. And he did, and it took it in a totally different direction. But I love it. I enjoy it. I love these characters. I have been writing these characters for 30 years. So they really are my, I call them my imaginary friends. And I say imaginary friends because I've had people want to know where they are and ask for phone numbers of my imaginary characters. And I have my answer for that. I've had it enough that I have my answer for that. My answer, if it's, if somebody asked in person, I go, "Well, if Jason were real, he would not want me to give out his phone number to somebody I don't know." And they go, "Oh, okay. Yeah." Jason actually has been the top person people have asked for his phone number over the years.
Wow.
Both men and women. Everybody likes Jason. He just seems like some very approachable, apparently. I miss him greatly now that he's moved to New York in the series. But no, I don't have an overall plan. I had 13 plots when I started out. I've used all of them up long ago. And the fact that I have the great honor to still be writing and having a best-selling series as I write, tw as 29 comes out, is amazing to me. And certainly, I didn't think I would ever have the privilege of having a series that goes on this long and is this popular.
I love it. I was talking to a coworker about, she's like, "Oh, are you gonna do the podcast?" I was like, "Yeah." And I was saying how, just seeing the difference, because when I started reading them a few years ago, we just had like the mass market paperback versions of the books. So I was like, "Oh yes, like trade one in, let's read, read." And then as we started getting like the hardcovers for the library, and I found out one of my coworkers, she doesn't work here, she's retired. She loved the series. I was like, wait, what? Really? I was like, I could have talked to her all these years about the book because no one else I knew read it, but I'd promote it to like the readers that would come to our events. I was like, it's not your stereotypical, like, because I feel like when people think of, if you say like, it's kind of like a urban fantasy romance or paranormal romance, they're kind of like, not my cup of tea. But there's so much, because you said like, you have the mystery of like what goes on. It's so much more than that. And like, that's first, like, it got me. I was like, oh, cool, like paranormal romance. Like, I'm into it. But what kept me going was the depth and detail of the, like I said before, the world building. But some of the stuff that goes on, I'm like, this is wild. Like, I need to know more. And just like what's coming to my head is when I was, for your 26th or 26th book, I can't talk today, Serpentine, I was like, I remember cataloging the book and like getting ready to put it on the shelves. I was like, oh yeah, like when you could revisit back into like a previous book or something of that. I love doing that with series that I read. I'm like, yes, this is like, we could kind of connect dots, and almost like I have my own conspiracy pin board of like, ooh, what's gonna happen?
It is, well, I know I have fans that reread the series every time before another book comes out. And weirdly, they actually know more minutia than I do at this point from all the books. During lockdown was the first time I had read all the books as they were published and took notes. What I would do in the past is, if I had a character that hadn't been on stage for a long time, I'd go back and read the books where they were on stage. But I didn't have the time. I was too busy writing the next book to read all the books. But over lockdown, I went, no. And I read everything in order from the beginning. And I was able to make notes of plot lines that never got followed, or characters that I'd forgotten about, or characters I'm glad I, don't want him on stage or her on stage again. But so I was able to look at it as a whole. And it's like, I wish I'd put an extra book between book 8 and book 9. I wish I'd done a extra book between 8 and 9 where we see Richard and Anita try to get the wedding off the ground, and what happened and what went wrong, because the serious Richard fans did not take it well that we went from the end of book 8, Blue Moon, where it seemed like there was a wedding in the offing, and then they were fine with book 9. Everybody loves Obsidian Butterfly, except for my readers that are mostly romance. If you are into the mystery, if you are into the supernatural, everybody loves Obsidian Butterfly. The only people who think it's too harsh and too scary are the people that are primarily romance readers. And because there is not, because some books are more mystery, some books are more horror, some books are have more romance, I have fans across the gamut. And so the fans that are not there for the romance, but there for the horror elements and the mystery elements and everything, they basically I need to they want to ask, is this a kissing book? They want, is this a kissing book, or is this just the mystery and the necromancy and give me that. And so it's like I almost feel like going, yes, this is a kissing book. No, this is not a kissing book. Obsidian Butterfly was not a kissing book. It was very sensual, but I still have readers that tell me it was one of the most frightening books I've written. The scene in the hospital, some of the scenes in the hospital, people still come up and go, oh my God, for that one. I good job. I've scared them for decades. There you go. So it's interesting. The fan base is so broad, and the fan base, I have two families that have told me that they have coffee clashes over 4 generations about my books. That they have the granddaughter, let's see, granddaughter, mother, great grandmother, grandmother, mother, daughter. Most
That's
people's,
awesome.
and are, I have the other one is grandmother, mother, daughter, and her daughter's now old enough. So 4 generations, and they're all reading the books and having coffee clutches, and it's really brought them closer. And I have military spouses where it's usually the wife that is home and the husband that is deployed, and she will read him the new book over their time over the phone calls that they get, and I mean, I love that. I love that it's broad enough to bring so many people together and generations together. I mean, how cool is that?
That's really cool.
Do you feel, and I think I know the answer to this, just kind of talking a little bit about it, because your fan base is so broad, and do you feel like you have a responsibility to feed all of those pieces, or are you basically like the story just kind of tells you what it needs to be at the time, and if somebody is expecting a kissing book and they don't get it, too bad.
I can't. I the fans got into my head quite a bit at some point early about mid books. Sometimes in a good way. I mean, Obsidian Butterfly. So many people said they wanted to see Edward at home, and Ted Forrester at home and his alter ego, and that was partially I wanted to see it, and the fans wanted to see it. So that's in a good way. And Edward told me he lived in Albuquerque. He lived near Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I said, "You can't live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I am your writer. I created you, and I've never been to Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can't live someplace I've never been." As soon as I stepped off the plane in Albuquerque, I went, "Damn it, you do live here." And so the fact that he lives in that area, it was his idea somehow. So that was a good way. Then when the book 10 came out, which is Narcissus in Chains, and I brought in introduced the character of Micah Callahan, some of the Serious Richard fans had some serious problems, and some of my traditional romance fans had some serious problems. The polyamory really bothered people, and they were so horrible to me on the tour for Narcissus in Chains that I said, "You're bothered by the sex and the polyamory? Hold my coat. Hold my beer." And there was so much negative fan interaction from that's one of the reasons that there is so much heat and spice in the middle books, because it was a response. You tell me not to do something, I'm going to go ahead and do it. Therapy has let me know that that is also a type of control and giving away of my power. If I am doing something to thwart you because you're being mean to me, that still means, in a way, I'm letting your energy control mine. I don't do that anymore. I'm healthier, but the middle books are very much a hold my beer. And so it was interesting to have enough therapy to realize, look back and go, okay, I can chill. I don't have to do that anymore. So now I'm trying for a balance. Now I'm trying for a balance of the mystery, the horror, the police procedural, because she's a U.S. Marshal. She has her own badge now, which at the beginning of the series, she was just a consultant for the police. And they're preternatural branch of the U.S. Marshal Service. I got to do the research on that. They had women before any other branch of police in this country. They still have most. Last I checked, it's been a little bit, they had more women in that branch. It's one of the reasons I chose it. That so many reasons, but U.S. Marshal Service, it was chosen from research, not just out of the hat. So yes, I now do have a fan base that both wants something as deeply mystery and thriller and military-esque as Obsidian Butterfly, and I also have readers that want something is super spicy as I don't know. Pick one of the middle books, man. And I can't do all in every book. I can't do it all. There's no way. And then just a straight mystery with necromancy. Some people say, I want to see the necromancy on stage more. You can't do all of it in one book. You just can't. So I do have to choose. But I am no longer letting negative fan interaction dictate to me or make me react. I am trying to stick with positive reactions. Like if people tell me that a certain character. One of the interesting things in the series, though, is at the very beginning with Guilty Pleasure, the first three books were pretty much, first two books were out before I realized how big the series was growing, how serious the fans were about the book. And so I would, in book one, you can, in book two, you can, in book one, you can find every place. Every place is real. The house where they have the vampire freak party is real. You can drive to it. I give directions enough you can drive to it. I found out that strangers were knocking on their door trying to find the freak party in real life. And that was why, by the third book, Circus of the Damned, the cave where Anita almost dies because it's a partially underwater cave, and one of the most dangerous diving you can do in the world is cave diving. One of the reasons I moved that cave to a section of the St. Louis area that doesn't have a cave, and it's hard to find a section of St. Louis without a cave under it. Let me just say that part. One of the reasons I moved it so there was absolutely no cave near it was because I didn't want people trying to recreate her entrance to the cave where she almost dies. And first signing I did for Circus of the Damned, I had this nice couple. They look perfectly wonderful, but they come up and they were mad at me because they couldn't find the cave because they wanted to duplicate what she'd done when she almost died in the cave.
Failed successfully, as they say, right?
And because they weren't going to have me to write their way out. And I said, and that's why I moved the cave, because it's very dangerous and I wouldn't want anything to happen to you. And I wouldn't be there to write you a good ending. And they went, oh, okay. And that's why I move things around now. And if anything bad happens in a residence, a place of business, a hotel, I will be vague. I will not tell you where it is because I do not want to feed the monster or the lack of wisdom roll, the lack of the fail of that wisdom roll. I don't want to feed that. So for everyone's safety, I started getting much more vague after that. And it's a shame because we could have had, St. Louis tourism like Anne Rice had for New Orleans, but I guess Ms. Rice didn't have fans trying to duplicate things the way I do.
I don't want to give anything away, and I also don't want to, because you said that the next book is coming out. But what I guess, like, one of my questions is, like, do you have a favorite character that you would like to sort of spend more time with, that you would like to put on stage a little bit more, if you can say?
I do. I think that Dev and all the Gold Tigers have not gotten enough stage time. Dev and Angel have not gotten enough stage time. And I miss Jason since he moved to New York to be with the love of his life and to be a professional ballet dancer. Who'd have thunk it, when we started with this character. And I love that he's trying to live his best life, but I miss him. He's one of Anita's best friends. He's Nathaniel's best friend. And so, I know he's coming in to try on his clothes for the wedding because he's going to be in the wedding and everything. So we're going to see him. But Jason, I'm really missing Jason. Seriously, he just brought a certain energy to the series that I'm missing. A level of fun, no matter what's happening. So. Jason and Deb, Mephistopheles, our devil, he hasn't gotten enough, and neither has Angel, his sister. And so those are the characters I feel haven't been on stage enough, haven't explored enough. There's a lot there for the Gold Tigers. There's a lot there, and I'll be honest, if I could go back in time now, I might try to hive off the tigers. to their own series and just keep them in Vegas and stuff and not bring them into the already large, complicated poly group that Anita and Jean-Claude have in St. Louis. But, you know, if hindsight is 2020 kind of thing. So they don't get enough stage time. They're so cool. Their culture is so cool, and I never get to show it. The other thing is I want to do another book with Raphael and the Were-Rats, where they're majorly on stage and I have more time to explore their culture. But I'm so glad I waited to have them on stage until I had done Kali and Filipino, which is Filipino martial arts blade work. It totally filled out, fleshed out their culture in a way I couldn't have foreseen, you know, 30 years ago when I created it, because Raphael and the Were-Rats are the only shapeshifters on stage in Guilty Pleasures. So yes. Yes, I have so many ideas and so many things I'm looking forward to.
Awesome.
And that's the other thing is I still am having so much fun and love my world and my characters. The people that have come to me and asked me how I'm keeping my series so vibrant and alive and enjoying myself are all people that have literally told me they read me and they loved my world. They wanted to do their own version of it. And sometimes their stuff is great. It's really fun and it's popular. But it was not their original, it isn't something that they've loved since childhood. It isn't something that they've been interested in since for decades. It isn't something that speaks to them or comes from a place of deep inspiration for them. It's something they're interested in, something they enjoyed. For me, this is the bedrock of who I am as a writer. So I think that the difference is that as a writer, you should really find what speaks the most to you. No matter if it's what's selling, if it doesn't speak to you, that is a bastardization of your muse. It's almost a betrayal of your muse. And I think that's why I did research before I sat down to write Anita. If you read any series, I don't care what genre it is, there are more long-running mystery series, so let's take that. Around the book 5 to 8, they obviously fall out of love with either their main character or their world. And there is that slump from starting at 5 to 8. If they're lucky, they get their mojo back going and they're fine after that little slump. But you can always tell that that's what happens. And I didn't have that because I gave myself a big enough world. I gave myself mystery and horror, romance by accident. And I gave myself so many places to play in such a big world. I never got tired of my world. And I think that if it's what you want to write more than anything, if it's what really moves you, you don't get tired of it because it's what your muse wants to write. If you're only writing to make money, I think for most writers, it eventually shows. Even if they were enjoying it at the beginning, it's hard to keep it going after 5 books. Because your initial enthusiasm and inspiration can wear out if you don't find new things to be inspired by. No, but so they asked me this question and they're genuine and I don't know how to tell them. My answer to them was you have to find a new way to be inspired and interested in your series and your character. And because you can't go all the way back to the creation of the world to give yourself a bigger world. That ship has sailed. So find new ways and new interests in the world.
I pulled up from your website the series to remember all the names because you have 29. I was curious what inspired your names because I love them and the book covers because they're all so different and cool.
Well, thank you. The titles originally were going to all be named after vampire businesses. I didn't know I'd be doing this many books. So eventually our business is owned by the supernatural. And I didn't understand how many books I'd be doing. So I ran out of names. The Killing Dance was supposed to be named Dance Macabre after the dance club that Jean-Claude opened. But there was another book from my publisher named Dance Macabre, the one by Stephen King. Even though it had been out for a few years, they didn't want confusion. My editor at the time said, no, we have to have a different title. But I did have a business title for that, The Killing Dance. But by the time, Obsidian Butterfly is pretty much one of the last ones. Incubus Dreams is named after the strip club, but I just ran out of business names. And so I had to change to something else. Narcissus in Chains is a business name. That's probably the last one in a row. But after that, it is a conference call. They do a conference at my publisher. We do conference calls on the phone about covers, about titles. What will be the title? What will be the title? You don't want anything that's too similar. You want something that has something. I want something that has to do with the book. That is not always the highest priority, but I want something that has to do with the book. And it has to be a cool title, something recognizable. I mean, so much goes into title choosing. When you get to this level in traditional publishing, covers, I had no say on the early covers. Nada. Zip. I was a new writer. I had no track record. Even though the series was growing, no one cared what I thought. Except when I asked for them to not do the original pulp covers, I said, well, what do you want? I said, how about more cityscapes? These are mysteries. So I sent postcards from St. Louis to my editor, and she did forward them to the art department. So there's some that have those cityscapes. Those are from postcards that I sent them to see if they would use them. So I was very lucky that they used those. But Obsidian Butterfly, I didn't know it was going to be a body part cover in the original until I saw the book. I had no idea what it was going to be. I love the original cover. The reason there are tool covers and object covers is because fans told me that they were teachers. The men said they were getting little old ladies hitting them with purses on the subway, thinking they were reading porn in public. And they would say, please stop doing the body part covers. Please can't you redo the covers with something that doesn't get me, you know, people mad at me, or I'm going to lose my job if I keep reading this at work and everything. So I went to my publisher and asked them to do the new covers that are still on, the tool covers and the scary tool covers, so they would look less like something that would get everybody in trouble. And then you know what? Nobody ever said, thank you, that helps me at work. They complained, but when I fixed it, nobody came back and said thank you. And isn't that always the way? We're more likely to complain than compliment. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that people that are shelf purists, they are very upset that the covers do not match now. And so now we're back to vaguely body part covers, more sensual looking covers, scary sensual covers. And we still have that middle section that has the tool covers, and the shelf purists are just they're just so unhappy with it. I have put in a request to my publisher. Could we redo the covers to make them look alike of the early covers we redid? But since they already changed the covers once because I wanted to help my fans, I don't know. I may have lost a little street cred there that I want to change them yet again. And it's not inexpensive to change the covers again. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if we can get them to all have the same look. But yes, the early pulp covers, then we had the vague, scary cityscape because I sent postcards. And then the body part covers they came up with at my publisher. And I think I didn't have, I think I started to have some say with my new editor, my new agent, and would give bounce some ideas for some covers. Some I have more influence on than others. But I am very lucky to have influence on my covers. Most people don't. Most authors will never get a chance to influence the covers that their books have in traditional publishing. Indie publishing, whole different thing. But traditional publishing, it is very rare to have this much input into your covers. And that does mean that if I do a big push for a cover and it doesn't sell well, then that was my idea. So there's an upside and a downside to having that much influence.
No, this is a beautiful cover. I think that that's what I was about to say. What do you, this is a gorgeous cover.
Actually, I came up with the concept for this one. I'm very proud of it. Nice. But ooh. I can't draw. Nothing on God's green earth will make me be able to draw. So I can come up with, like, I'll hunt up photographs and everything, and then I send it in and go, this is the idea. If they like it, they will use it. If they don't like it, then they come up their own and we go back and forth. But I was very pleased that they liked it off the bat, the burning flowers. And there are a surprisingly number of people who have set flowers on fire online. It's actually a fairly popular motif. I didn't know that until I started looking. And so smolder, because the fire. And we have a potential motif for the next cover for Slay. And so it's been interesting. It's interesting. And that's all I can say, because I don't know if they're going to go with that motif. So I'm not going to tell you what it is, because I don't know. We may come up with a different idea. But I was very pleased. A lot of people have said smolders have really liked the cover for Smolder and said it was beautiful.
It's really nice.
I like it because it's got that mix of danger, scary, and sensual, bordering on romantic. Like the romance has gone terribly pear-shaped, you know. The flowers are on fire. And so, yeah, I'm very pleased with the cover. It is beautiful. And I still don't have my copy. My copy is supposed to ship a few days ago, and they're having some technical difficulties on our end with, never mind. I should get it today. I should see the book today.
This has been so much fun. Thank you so much. So we are looking forward to Slay, and check out Smolder. And Laurel K. Hamilton, thank you so much for chatting with us. This is a pleasure.
It's been so much fun.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been great talking to you guys.
Come back.
I will happily come back, and we will chat some more.
We're gonna close this chapter of Turn the Page.
That's what I was gonna say.
One of your librarian hosts, Stacy.
Our author guest was
Laurel K. Hamilton.
We did that backwards, but I'm totally cool with that.
It works. Doesn't matter.
Going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.